Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday morning. It's the 21st of June, 14 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. Good morning. Hope you had a beautiful weekend. Hope if you celebrated such that you had a beautiful Father's Day and that we are together now. And that is a good thing. So we welcome you to join us. You can write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We're going to talk about a lot of stuff today. If you would like to comment on any of those things that we're talking about. And, you know, yes, read in between the blanks. Comment on what we're commenting on would be helpful. Panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir.
Good morning to you, sir, and I am relatively happy.
Excellent. That is good. We'll take that. I like the relative happiness. Mm-hmm. We are more than relatively happy that immigration attorney and partner for the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, is back. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So good to have you here. Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson, makes her triumphant return to the studio for the first time since the dreaded lockdown, and it's great to see your face.
I'm a little too excited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you were here. It was like your first day of school.
It was.
Yeah, that's great.
Are you here at 8:30?
Almost.
Yeah. Very exciting. Libby just walked in fashionably early.
Thank you.
Libby Post is a political consultant and our dear friend. And good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm good.
Excellent. All right. Let's get started. And we welcome you again, panel@wamc.org. Try to get to as many topics as we can. That is always our goal. Sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. But here we go. We go with Joe Manchin's power issues. I see what you all were talking about.
Yeah.
If you click the link, it's the wrong link.
Right.
You guys are
I found it though.
You guys are better. Yes, you did. All right, give me 2 seconds.
Okay.
You know what? Let's just start with that story. So the push for LGBTQ civil rights stalls in the Senate as advocates search for Republican support. We will start with the story that I put into sent everybody a couple of times. The long march toward equal rights for gay, lesbian, and transgender Americans whose advocates have eyed major advances with complete Democratic control in Washington has run into a wall of opposition in the Senate. Please act surprised. Foundering alongside other liberal priorities such as voting rights, gun control, and police reform, legislation that would write protections for LGBTQ Americans into the nation's foundational civil rights law. Let me say that again. Legislation that would write protections for LGBTQ Americans into the nation's foundational civil rights law has stalled because of sharpening Republican rhetoric, one key Democrat's insistence on bipartisanship in the Senate's 60-vote supermajority rule. While Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer hinted at potential action this month, the annual LGBTQ Pride Month, Senate aides and advocates say there are no immediate plans to vote on what is being called the Equality Act, which would add sexual orientation and gender identity to the protected classes of the 1964 Civil Rights Act alongside race, color, religion, and national origin. Libby, let me go to you first because it's just shocking. I don't know. You just think to yourself, wow, we're adding this to a Civil Rights Act and we haven't done that already.
You know, what's interesting in all of this is that people think it's already done,
right?
Because we can get married,
right? Once the gay marriage ruling came down,
right.
This was the case.
But the fact of the matter is, we can get married in Arkansas, but we can get fired for getting married in Arkansas, and because there are no protections around employment or housing or education, And this is now all predicated. I mean, they're okay with the lesbians and the gays. They're dealing with the lesbians and gays. That's, you know, I can deal with that. Now they're targeting the transgender community because they don't understand. They don't want to understand. And they are using they're using almost like Lavender Menace kind of argumentation. That was done by Betty Friedan and with Now back in the 70s around lesbians, around transgender folks with, you know, oh, men are going to go into the women's room where women are the most vulnerable and attack them. It's like, give me a break. You know, this is just the typical either A, I'm ignorant and I want to stay that way. B, I'm not so ignorant, but politically this is going to keep me elected. Or C, I just hate anybody who's different than I am. And I think that there's a lot of ignorance around transgender, around the transgender community, and people not wanting to know. But I also think that there's an issue of male privilege here. And I think that some of these Republican men who get their privilege because they're men and they have male genitalia, I hate to put it this way, cannot even fathom the idea of somebody giving that up and then taking a step down, because they see it as a step down to transitioning to become a woman. And so I think that there's that whole thing that nobody really ever talks about. But I think that that's part of what's going on in the back of a lot of these guys' minds. They all know that the sports issues, the bathroom issues are just ridiculous.
Because we went for the bathroom issues, North Carolina, and we went and sort of fought that battle. No real winner.
No.
But now it seems that the messaging has turned to sports,
yes,
which is odd.
Yes, it is. It is odd. You know, when you're taking estrogen to balance out the testosterone, that doesn't mean the testosterone is still as strong and dominant in your body as it once was. And so the sports stuff just, you know, we're not talking about the Russians in the 60s in the Olympics, where we really couldn't tell whether somebody was a man or a woman. And
yeah, they're telling you what they're doing.
Right, right. You know, they were really clear about this. That's not what we're talking about, folks, but I think people conjure that in their minds, those who remember that. But they are using this as, well, it's not fair to, you know, girls to be competing against other girls who used to be boys and they can be stronger. Well, you know what? Girls can be pretty strong too. Sorry. I watched the Olympic trials last night.
Yes,
I watched those women on the steeplechase. I was like, oh my God.
No, you know, those things don't move.
Oh my,
I know. I couldn't believe it.
I know. They don't. No, and I was like, ugh. So don't tell me that women aren't strong. And that's what this is. This is saying women aren't strong. And it's not true.
I mean, for myself, I just find it very offensive that they brought it down to the youth and to the sports aspect. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have the NCAA, who's always like, this is just for, you know, competitive. This is why we don't pay our NBA, our you know, college players and all of this. And then all of a sudden, this is where they want to hang their hat, right?
This and medical care.
Yes.
This and medical care, not provide making it illegal to provide transgender medical care for anybody who's 18 or younger.
And adoptions.
Yes.
I mean,
right.
This is patriarchy personified. I'm not surprised it's sports, right? Because there's still a need for a women's movement in sports too. And Libby, the idea of a woman identifying as a man too is sort of is taking the entering into the privilege
in
role, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
No, you're not allowed to do that.
Yeah.
How
yeah.
dare you?
I know, but I can't tell you how many times I get called sir. You know, it's like, it just is what it is because of the way I present. I'm a lesbian, but it's just the way I present. But yeah, the idea that a woman is going to transition and take that male privilege? It's a zero-sum game.
Can I ask you, and then if this is a personal question, and if it bothers you, please, I don't.
Oh, well, in front of 400,000 people.
No. just wave me off and I'll stop.
Okay.
But you mentioned the thing about the bathrooms, and I have a dear person in my life who presents similarly, and just told me a horrible story about going into the bathroom and being screamed at for being a man and a pervert and going into the women's room and why don't you use your own room. My question was to her, and it is to you, has that always been the case, or is that increasing? I mean, has it gotten worse in the sense of where we are now because people seem more empowered to be jerks?
Well, I think it probably is. It hasn't happened to me in a while. I can tell you that when I walk into a woman's room on the thruway, I stand up as straight as I can, you know?
Yeah.
But it has happened. And when it does happen, I'm very clear. I just turn around and say, I sit down just like you do. and that's that. And, you know, it shuts them up. But, yeah, I mean, it does happen. And I think it happened. I mean, I'm 63. It's going to be a little more difficult for people to come after me just because I'm older. But for younger folks, for younger young lesbians who are butch and present like I did when I was 20, sure. For young trans men or trans women who are going into the women's room, you know, and may not look exactly like they think you should look, yes, it's a horrible thing to have to put up with, that's for sure. And for young trans men to go into a men's room, it can be as equally as dangerous and disturbing.
Which gets back to the whole why the bathroom issue is really an issue and should just be where you have...
Right, where you're most comfortable.
Which gender neutral.
Right. I mean, you know, I don't know if I'd want to go as far as all bathrooms are gender neutral because, honestly, I don't want to go into a men's room.
No, but I guess I'm in a private bathroom.
Oh, yeah. The one...
No, I understand. Yeah,
the one-seaters should all be gender neutral. What difference does it make?
Exactly.
But what's concerning is that they're having this conversation about around trans youth. And so it's highlighting all of these young people mm-hmm. who are dealing with this in their schools, right? So I saw the interview the other day on the news about these two young track stars. So not only are they dealing with transitioning, but they're also dealing with this conversation about whether or not they can run track. And I mean, I just think it's very unfortunate when we, as I know as a parent nowadays, when we go to soccer, everyone's a winner. That's not supposed to matter. Everyone gets a trophy. But then you step back and all of a sudden we're having this conversation where mm-hmm. these, you know, trans girls are not allowed to, you know, run with the girl team. I just,
you know, but the thing is that 20, 30 years ago, that's what they were saying about lesbians and gays. Mm-hmm. And in 20, 30 years, this will not be an issue anymore because more people will know other trans folks and it'll become more normalized. It's just the way we work. As long as, of course, the church and the radical Christian right doesn't totally take over America. That's the only caveat here. You know, it's the politics of it.
Oh, and that's the big fight.
Right.
And it's going to be written in the law. It's easier to buy a key fob at Target. And accept that as pride. It's a lot harder to sell to your constituents for these mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. who apparently represent a lot of hate-filled individuals that other humans should have the same rights as them, you know? And they're probably doing it with their ally shirt on because that's trendy.
So, Alan, let me ask you about this with Chuck Schumer saying, you know, we can have some movement on this. And I'll open this up to you, but to everybody, is that true?
You know what, Joe? It's all about politics. The word politics hasn't entered into our discussion yet. But you can be sure that they're looking at the polls and that they're looking at what people will accept or not. And they haven't reached. Schumer is brilliant and correct to raise this as a very important thing and a movement. But, you know, both the Republican and Democratic parties are facing an election in 22 and they don't want to get caught. In this mess. And so, you know, to some degree, they're going to stay out of it. So it's a political issue. It shouldn't be, of course, but it is a political issue. And people are making up their minds, parties are making up their minds, whether they dare do what's right as opposed to what's political.
Well, I don't want this bill to come up and fail.
Exactly.
That's
right.
The other thing.
Yeah.
You know, we had that in marriage in New York, and the TU just had a great retrospective on the marriage bill.
Who did?
The Times Union.
Oh, okay.
10 years later for New York State. And in 2009, the first time it went at it, it failed. And it really put a damper on the prospects of it getting passed. And it wasn't until Cuomo came into office and the political dynamics changed that we were able to get it done. So I wouldn't want to see this go to the Senate and fail out of the gate. I know that it takes time to get bills passed and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I'm a lobbyist. I get that. But I think if it goes after the House passes and it goes to the Senate and it fails, I think the Senate Republicans will be able to use that as a cudgel in the 2022 election.
Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, one of two openly gay senators, said that she has quietly been lobbying Republican colleagues on the issue and that there has been only incremental progress. She said, so as long so long as negotiations are productive and we're making progress, I think we should hold off on a vote. There may be a time when there's an impasse. I'm still trying to find 10 Republicans. So that leads, that's to your point of let's not do this and have it fail.
Right. Right. And I think that there are Republicans who would vote for it if it was any other political time.
Yeah.
And not this one.
The House passed the legislation in February, 224 to 206, with only three Republicans joining all 221 Democrats in support. And then, of course, that brings us to Joe Manchin, is a Democratic holdout in the Senate, and the one Republican who had sponsored a previous version of the bill, Senator Susan Collins, is not yet doing so in this Congress. So the names that we always talk about as being... the sticky wickets, as my mother would call them, continue to be. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue with our wonderful panel. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Libby Post, Sarah Rogerson. We will continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. First, we'll have a break, and then news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our program this morning. It is Monday, the 21st of June, 34 minutes past 9 o'clock. We have letters on the subject that we were talking about, which was the Equality Act stalling amid GOP attacks on transgender rights. We get this from several letters. We got this one from Bob. The majority of men opposed to any sexuality other than alpha heterosexual are either afraid of their own feelings or have been indoctrined, indoctrinated by religious teachings that control women and men's bodies and feelings. It may be patriarchal, but a lot of brainwashed women support this type of ignorance and fear.
True.
Yeah, a lot of them voted for Trump.
I was just going to say the same thing.
I mean, you know.
Erica writes, this is the most trivial thing to oppose as a politician, in my view. First, the amount of people this helps is small and really non-threatening to anyone. Second, we all know by now, even if we give transgender all rights in the world, they will still be discriminated against. All any employer has to do is to make up a reason, and that person is fired. The idea that these laws will somehow change the fabric of our nation is absurd. It takes nothing away from white males. Someone tell them that.
Hear, hear.
And then we go to Marty with the subject line, oh, please. Oh, please. They can't even admit that straight slash all women are equal by passing the Equal Rights Amendment. How many years? How many more years? I don't get it, but there it is. Then... Michelle writes about transgender sports. Please, education is needed. I do not understand the rationale in sports. If I were a female athlete, I don't know that I would consider it fair that a transgender female would compete in the same sport. There are biological differences with bone length, muscle strength, etc. I don't know enough about biology to speak intelligently here, but I presume there are some basic facts about a body that cannot be changed. And I can't imagine that a female who becomes a trans man can compete at the same level against male body structure, even with hormone treatment. I don't think that can change fully bone and muscle structure. Please, I have no challenges with trans bathroom use, etc., but I truly don't understand the sports issue. I think that this is a point that even trans supportive people need education on.
Oh, everyone's looking at me.
Well, I don't know. I don't.
I think that's probably true, but I just want to, every time I think about sports, I just want to blow up the system in terms of like, you know, then we need to figure out new metrics for how we decide competitive pools, right? So let's get out of the gender construct. I know that's scary and I know it's hard and I know it requires people to actually value humans for their worth and their ability in the sports setting. But like, also like, do we need it to be competitive? You know, I get to these sort of underlying questions that make me sound crazy.
Well, no, they don't make you sound crazy, but not at all. On the contrary, I think, though, that we do. I also look at that letter and I think to myself, so who cares? I understand, like, if it's professional athletics, I guess those issues can apply more. But if you're a kid playing on a field, who cares?
Exactly. That's my point.
If they win or lose, I mean, who cares?
But it also takes me back to the conversation, and I don't know enough to speak on it, but I remember something similar when women were going to enter the Army.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The similar conversation. Can they protect us? Mm-hmm. Can they have our back? And they're there now. And
right.
they're protecting their fellow, you know, Marines, Navy, whatever. I mean, this same conversation has happened before.
And there are, not plenty, but there are folks who have been in the armed forces, men, who have, once they get out, have transitioned. And so, yeah, they're there. They're protecting your back. So give me a break.
Charlotte Clemmer being one of the more famous ones.
Yeah. So, you know, there's...
In my head, I just think of the movie Mulan.
Right.
Climbing, competing with the guys. It can happen.
Oh, yeah.
It does happen.
David writes, I am a proud member of a progressive Episcopal church. We have bruises from fighting for equality. One of the panelists equated the church with a radical Christian right. Please do not equate that. It hurts our mutual cause for justice.
That's not what I said, nor what I mean. I understand that there are very progressive Christian denominations, and I value them and thank God that they exist. But when I talk about the church, I mean the Catholic Church. And when I talk about the radical Christian right, I mean the radical Christian right, the folks on the right who are using Christianity as a cudgel and a shield against any kind of social progress. So just to be clear about that.
Not to further parse it, but there are also very progressive Catholic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But right now, the Catholic Church... And what they're trying to
as
do
an
around,
entity,
right,
you're
around
absolutely
communion,
right.
communion yeah. even no. though the Pope said not to do it,
yes.
the American bishops did, is absurd.
Yes.
Did the American bishops actually do it, or did they say they were going to do it?
I think
As I remember, there was a big debate over that issue. So I don't know. I know that they wanted to.
Well, just the fact that they've made it so public will give... license to local parish priests or local, what do they call, bishops, to do it. I mean, I remember when Ratzenhofer first came here, the new Catholic bishop here, and he took on choice, and he went after Kathy Sheehan, and he went after Assemblywoman Pat Fahey.
That's his name.
And it was...
Scharfenberger.
Ratzenberger's the other guy.
Yeah.
The former
yeah,
pope.
He's the...
Scharfenberger. Yeah. So... But he went after, you know, two prominent Catholic women who were elected officials. And it did not go well for him, actually. It did not go well. And they stood their ground. But it was really painful.
Slight tangent, but after...
Yes. Sorry.
A contentious debate. No, I'm adding to the tangent. After a contentious debate, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has voted to move forward with a process that could call into question the eligibility of politicians like President Biden to receive communion. The bishops voted 168-55 in favor of drafting a formal statement on the meaning of the Eucharist and the life of the Church, officials announced. This is dated June 18th, so this was just last week.
So doesn't the Pope have to go along if that happens?
No, the Pope has said no to this.
That's what I'm saying. But in other words, you know, he's the Pope. And as Mario used to tell me all the time, he's in charge. He's the final word.
So one would think the bishops would have to go along with the Pope instead of the Pope going along with the bishops.
Yes, one would think that.
During their online meeting, bishops held a spirited discussion Thursday before voting on the proposal to direct the Bishops' Committee on Doctrine to draft the statement. Such a document, once completed, could include guidelines for denying communion to public officials. Bizarre. Okay.
Well, Biden said it wasn't going to happen. That was his statement. Don't worry about it. It's not going to happen. So what does he know that we don't know?
Well, and also, it doesn't... talk to these scores of Catholics who are pro-choice.
The overwhelming majority of Catholics are pro-choice.
Right, who attend communion every week. Okay, let's get back. Let me see. We'll go back to the letters, and then we'll take a break, and then we will come back and go to a new topic, I promise you. We go to, when it comes to high school sports, Joe asked the question, who cares? When it comes to high school sports, there's a lot of money in college scholarships given to top athletes. Okay. That doesn't change my question, but okay.
Yours is more of a philosophical thing.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, but yes, okay. I'm going to go, I defer to Sarah's thoughts on just blowing up the whole system, not even getting into that.
We give so many more scholarship dollars to boy athletes than girl athletes, so that needs to be blown up too.
Yep. Rob says, so why do we have men's and women's sports? Where is the line? Any panelist that doesn't have children shouldn't be able to comment on male identifying as a female playing soccer with 13-year-old females or using the bathroom. You just don't get it.
Got two parents here.
No, three.
Not a problem.
Three.
Not a parent. Not a problem.
Yeah. And not four. He's a parent, too.
He's a parent. I was thinking littles.
Oh, littles. Well, yeah. Mine's 35. He's not that little anymore.
Okay. So two parents.
Mine are in their 40s.
Yeah.
And when you talk to kids about this issue, by the way, which you know,
like,
I do, they don't get it at all.
No, they don't.
Because they have the language around it. They'll say, oh, you know, so my friend is showing up as a girl now. And we still play together.
Yeah.
That's it. Oh, and like it only comes up if you make an observation and they have to like explain it to you because you're a dense grown-up. Well, it doesn't come up. They just go with it.
And in my very limited experience on exactly what you're talking about, it's they only bring it up because someone else has pointed it out as quote-unquote a problem.
Right.
Or different.
A different, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your thoughts on these issues. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We will be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. Beautiful Monday morning it is. And let us go to this story. I want to talk about the New York City mayor's race, and we just have a few minutes before the top of the hour, and that seems like that'll probably do that story justice. So let us, not to belittle this story, but I, you know, we'll go with it. So they had another debate. So now Eric Adams and Andrew Yang tussled on questions of race in a frenetic day of campaigning 2 days before the July 22nd primary. So those of you keeping score at home, the primary is tomorrow.
Yes.
The leading candidates for mayor of New York City barreled into a frenzied final day of early voting on Sunday, a swirl of primary campaign activity marked by creative retail politicking and deepening acrimony between the race presumed frontrunner Eric Adams and the rest of the field. While the campaign trail was studded with lighthearted moments, like Catherine Garcia did yoga in Times Square, there was also serious clashes stemming from Ms. Garcia's late alliance with Andrew Yang, leading Mr. Adams and his surrogates to question the integrity of the election with 2 days until the June 22nd primary. Allies of Mr. Adams, the Brooklyn Borough president, went so far as to baselessly claim that the appearance of an alliance between Ms. Garcia and Mr. Yang amounted to voter suppression, even though such alliances are common in elections with ranked choice voting, which is the case now in New York City. This is the first mayoral election in New York City that is using ranked choice ballots, allowing voters to support up to five candidates in order of preference. Okay, Alan, so let us talk about the race overall, and then we can get into ranked choice voting.
Well, so as a political scientist of sorts, I think your designation runs out after a certain number of years. But in any case, I love this. This is so fascinating. The idea that you change the electoral system and that people begin to campaign based on those changes. So right now, Eric Adams is the leader. And you have Yang and others getting together and saying, since there's a transference of votes based on where you are, this is the way we have to play it. We're gonna team up in order to do this.
Yeah.
To me, the idea that Adams is the leader becomes very important, except that when he decries it as voter fraud, it means he's scared that it's going to work against him. So we'll see. He's a police captain, a former police captain. You have a city where people are being shot on the streets and kids are being put in the way of bullets. People are scared to death, and therefore Adams is the leader right now. But he might not be elected if these vote transferences go against him.
So by him saying voter suppression, how does that, like, what it,
I'm not sure.
How does that work?
Yeah. It doesn't work.
Well, there's what the candidate says, and then there's what the strategy actually is.
I mean, it means I'm going to lose, and therefore it's voter suppression.
I mean,
because people want me, because the polls are showing people want me to win.
Right.
So you're suppressing the vote if you move the votes to other. Okay.
It's like saying it's exactly what Trump said.
So let me ask you, Libby Post, who help candidates get elected. Do you like ranked choice voting?
She doesn't know yet.
I find the whole thing a little confusing. I get why they're doing it in New York, because there are so many, so it whittles things down so that people have more of a choice in the long run. We'll have to see how it works.
Musical chairs.
I don't see
it. Jury's still out.
Yeah,
there.
I do. And we'll see how that works in New York. I don't see it coming upstate anytime soon.
Remember the children's parties where they took the one chair away? There was one person.
Musical chairs.
Musical chairs.
Right, right.
That's what this is.
It is. It's a little strange, but... You know, I mean, what I'm thankful for is Andrew Yang is not going to be one of the choices. So that's a good thing.
Who said that?
Huh?
Who said that he's not going to be one of the choices?
Oh, he's down in the polls, and he's...
Yeah, but he's not number five. In other words, with the transference of votes...
I mean, he was the top guy for a while.
Because everybody knew who he was.
Right,
and,
right.
Then whatever happened.
So we'll see, but...
May I ask you're happy?
I just don't think... Look, his politics might be better than Trump's, but like Trump, he has no idea how government works. And I'm done with having people running for office and going into government who have no idea how government works. We saw what happened in the last 4 years of the Trump administration and how it almost destroyed not only our democracy, but the function of government. I believe in government. And he doesn't understand how it works. I just don't think it's more for him. It's a popularity contest more than anything else. I thought he was a joke when he ran for president.
Well, and capitalism doesn't translate into government.
Right.
Right.
Business, like you can't run government like you run a business. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't.
Is it a silly question, Alan, to ask why so many people want to be the mayor of New York City?
No. In fact, being mayor of New York City is one of the most important positions in government in this country. And you will all remember that there have been lots of examples of people like Bloomberg, who was urged to run for governor, which is a higher office. Obviously, the city is a creature of the state. Remember that. And he wouldn't even look at Bloomberg. Wouldn't even look at the governor.
Bloomberg ran for president. De Blasio ran for president.
Well, yes, but mayors of New York seldom end up. There's a big debate over TR, but you seldom get to be president.
No, John
and
Lindsay
of course,
didn't.
But they're national. But they are on the national stage, of course.
Yeah. They are. Yeah. They are, and of course, it's why Cuomo and the present mayor hate each other's guts. Because they both wanted to be president.
So this is probably a mean question, but because you sort of just asked or answered it rather. But if I'm asking you to get into the psyche of Andrew Cuomo, and I don't know if that's a fair question.
Oh,
but
no, it's a very fair question.
But so who?
I'm an expert on that.
So who? So is there anyone who could win this election that this governor won't hate?
No. No. I know Andrew pretty well, and I have to tell you that he has a basic operating standard, which is if you're not me, you're no good.
Okay, so whoever gets that is going to be in a position. Libby, would you sort of agree with that?
She's a lobbyist, for God's sakes, don't.
Yeah, but just for puppies and kittens.
I'll pass.
Okay. All right. Got it. Let's go to anybody else?
Yes?
No. Okay.
Yeah, nobody wants to touch that one.
The thing about de Blasio that is astounding is he's just not liked in New York City.
No.
And yet he pushes forward. What are his choices? You either push forward or you die.
What does he do next? That's another interesting thing.
What do you mean?
Well,
what does he do next? Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, you assume you write a book, you try to do something. I don't know.
I think you can do anything after running the financial capital of arguably the world.
Yeah. Somebody will hire you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, somebody will hire you, but, you know, like he's not going to face Cuomo in a primary or
anything. No.
Yeah. Okay.
You're
so.
Idiot. I mean, really.
There it is. There she is.
Let's see. We have letters. Jeremy writes, listen to you going all in on identity politics that makes us a loser. Why? Discuss why one of the most liberal cities in America is going for a law and order candidate. That is what makes it hard to be a Democrat.
Because people are getting shot in the streets. End of discussion.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's also something to the idea of where it feels intractable, you know, with Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter rhetoric. There's a lot of complicated dynamics in both of those banners. But the idea of most voters kind of want problem solvers, and it's actually useful to have someone who's been inside law enforcement to understand what actually helps improve law enforcement. And that speaks to a lot of voters in New York City, I think, who, you know, might have personal politics that say, I don't talk to cops. I don't work with cops. I won't be friends with them, but I might vote for one in order to solve the problems that need the expertise that he has.
He has it going two ways, I think. Number one, he was a captain of police. And people say, well, he's a policeman, and I'm going to vote for him because we need policemen right now running things because things are so dangerous. And on the other hand, he was a reformer within the police movement. And wanted more black people hired, for example, and kept saying so, and kept saying that, you know, there had to be a different approach to the way we did policing. So he's a beneficiary on both sides, I think.
Let's see. We also have this letter from, we're going back a story here on talking about when we were having our discussion on the Catholic Church. Helen says, perhaps if the church wants to be political, they should pay taxes. Then Nancy says the idea that this glass house will now pass judgment is laughable. That crack. All right, I'm going to stop. Must have been bad. Yeah. In this morning's TU, Bishop Scharfenberger, I believe, indicated that he would not support the U.S. bishop's involvement in denying communion since he did not believe the Eucharist should be politicized. Mm-hmm. Well, there's some promising news. Okay. So.
And the bishop in Washington, D.C., said he wasn't for it, also, as I remember it.
And this still goes back to remember those pictures of Mario Cuomo walking down, going toward communion in St. Patrick's, and of whether with the press just waiting to wondering whether the cardinal was going to give him.
There was a New York Post headline from a bishop who said, screaming over the front page of the New York Post, Mario will burn in hell.
Mm. Yeah. Yep. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. Is that okay? Are you ready, Ray? You're okay. Good. All right.
Ray's ready.
Ray's ready. It's a little early, but we'll take a break. We've reached a logical concluding spot, so we'll take a break. We'll come back, and we'll get to many more topics. We have a wonderful panel this morning: Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Libby Post, Sarah Rogerson. I'll say it for the 1,030th time: it's wonderful having you all in the studio. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And it's very nice to have you all with us. We have a lot to talk about, and I want to just get a couple of letters out of the way here. And when I say out of the way, I just mean so we can move on to our next topic and be nice and clean, and I don't have the detritus in my mailbox. Okay, let's go to Fred. Ranked choice voting is a very effective way to... Actually, I added very, is an effective way to revive our flagging democracy. One, it guarantees the winner of the election has to receive 50% plus one of the vote, eliminating candidates who win with only a plurality. Example, Nixon in 68, as I recall. And two, it enables voters to choose their first choice despite the candidate standing in the polls without the worry of the quote-unquote spoiler effect. This would especially help third-party candidates, such as Greens, but also major party candidates in a race with three or more candidates. If ranked choice voting had been in effect in Florida in 2000, we might have had a President Al Gore.
You know, maybe. But maybe not. I can give you one example of why it might not be good in quotes, and that is because we don't really know whether people will be so confused by the whole thing that they won't vote.
There's a tremendous amount of voter education that has to go on in order to make this work.
Yeah.
Let us go to this letter from, this is regarding, quote, Ms. Post.
Uh-huh.
I think you can already tell the tenor of it. Here we go. I would endorse the listener response today regarding the disparaging comments expressed by Libby Post. Libby needs to stop denigrating all people of faith, please.
I'm a person of faith, folks. Let me be very clear.
Libby was the president.
I was president of my synagogue. Let me be very, very clear about this. Saturday, we were finally able to go to Shabbat services, all of us together. It was wonderful. So don't say I'm not a person of faith.
Yeah.
I'm gonna finish the three more letters.
Yeah,
of
you
this
do
word.
That.
I don't have to.
Yeah,
was,
him.
Was that a threat?
He didn't write, write the letter.
No, Libby is entitled to an agnostic worldview, but she has consistently harmed the many WAMC listeners who support social justice issues working through communities of faith. Libby regularly speaks about religion with undifferentiated insults. Okay. I don't find that to be the case,
but
having worked
okay.
with you for a very long time.
Right.
But anyway.
I know, actually, on LinkedIn, it's my anniversary here on the round table. I started in 2013.
Mazel tov.
I think.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah.
That is very cool.
Yeah, isn't
that
it?
Is very cool.
It is. It is.
Wow.
I know. It's a long time.
Well, good. I actually can't believe it hasn't been longer. Well, because you were commentator.
I was doing commentary, and then I started right after you guys had me come in on to talk about marriage equality, and then you asked me if I'd like to come in and be a regular.
Yeah.
And I said, sure.
That is very
and
cool.
And here we go. Here
All
we
right.
Are.
I like that.
And you are as good as it gets.
Oh, thanks,
We
babe.
Were so smart then, and we are so smart now. Okay. Jade says, as a strong, fit woman who happens to be a lesbian, I do not support trans females competing in women's sports. There is a biological anatomy difference that cannot be denied. Many women athletes support my views. Martina Navratilova, Diana Nyad, to mention two. I do support civil rights, respect, and acceptance for all human beings. Okay. And again, that
I just want to remind our panelists that we do televise this thing up there. There's a camera that comes down.
Okay.
Takes a look at what, you know, is going on.
Yeah, if you go to WAMC.org and you want to go on the stream, you can see.
And then
you can see what gestures the panelists are making. We didn't have to worry about that for like a year and a half, so we're really out of practice.
But lest there be an insinuation that there was anything derogatory toward that listener, I think it's lifting up the how complicated this issue is and how difficult it is to break it down by gendered metrics. That's all.
You are such a good person.
Oh, thanks.
Let's see. We go to a new topic. Do we have one more letter? No, yeah, we're done. Okay. So let's go to a new topic, and that topic is let's talk about the since we have two immigration experts, we will talk about Title 42. Fewer migrant families being expelled at the border under Title 42, but critics still push for its end. This is an interesting issue that I will admit I just learned about because Sarah told me. U.S. Customs and Border Protection apprehension numbers for May released recently showed that the share of families about 20% being expelled under Title 42 continued to decline, although the overall number of families reaching the southwest border declined as well. The data shows that 8 out of 10 families that Border Patrol encountered were released into the country and allowed to pursue immigration cases. Hundreds more are being allowed to enter the United States more frequently under humanitarian exemptions. The public health order instituted by the Trump administration around the start of the pandemic and continued under President Biden expels most migrants to Mexico and other countries and are denying families a chance to make an asylum claim. But their experience in Mexico and subsequent separation have made them one of the thousands obtaining exemptions to the order after they were allowed into the country on humanitarian parole earlier this month. This in one particular case. So give us a brief a thumbnail sketch of what Title 42 is, and then we'll talk about how the Biden administration is and should be handling this.
Well, maybe for ease of reference, we should call it the Mike Pence rule. Because this was the making of the former vice president, who pressured and then eventually sort of strong-armed all of the relevant federal agencies, including the CDC, into accepting it as law because of our broken immigration code, which allows the executive to do certain things like this one under false pretenses. Consistently, even under the Trump administration, every federal agency said, we don't have a health-based justification for doing this. They did it anyway. And I am in conversations with a lot of immigration experts who wonder why this wasn't day one, right?
Could you explain to people like me who are not, you know, at your level, exactly what this is? I mean, I don't get it.
It just means that people can be turned away, and it's not expedited removal, but it's similar to that, where people can be turned away at the border even though they have valid asylum claims or asylum claims that they could present and pursue inside the interior of the United States, which is a lawful way to gain entrance to this country. And if there's a health-based justification for turning them back, then that's what they're doing. So under the Biden administration, fewer people are being turned back under Title 42. But the push now is to just get rid of it and go back to the rule of law without Mike Pence's perversion of it.
Okay, so what do? We get somebody coming to the border. Then I read something about putting them on an airplane and taking them from one place to another. What is that all about?
So the border spans hundreds of thousands of miles.
Yes.
It's vast. There are different ports of entry. A lot of folks present themselves at ports of entry, and that's a valid way to present an asylum claim. But there can be sometimes the groups of people coming are larger than that particular office can manage.
Yeah.
And so then they have to move people around in order to, quote unquote, process them. I'm using very sort of, I'm going to say whitewashed language for this, or language that makes it sound better than it is, just because that's sort of like the legal way that we talk about it. But really, we're moving people around in order to make it easier to deport them instead of making it easier for them to pursue their valid asylum claims in the United States. There were lots of different policies that did this to try to curb asylum seekers. And there are mixed results from this administration, although last week, great news that the Attorney General's office actually overturned two decisions that by the former Attorney General that made it increasingly difficult for women and people suffering gang persecution to pursue their claims under the United States asylum law. And so sometimes it's like five steps forward, two steps back with the Biden administration in immigration. And I think this is a really easy win for them because, like, this conversation reflects that, like, nobody, if you pull any average American off the street and say, what is Title 42? Nobody cares. Nobody knows. So, like, they could do this easily without and there's no, like, cause and effect. You repeal Title 42 and then, you know, Guatemalans fleeing for their lives are like, okay, now's the time to go to the border. Title 42 has been repealed. Like, nobody knows what the situation is at the border. And that's a problem in and of itself.
Santa.
I was going to just jump in on two things. One is there are places, and I think Sarah would agree, for them to go, though. And rather than turning them around, I know in Batavia right now, which is the immigration facility in upstate New York, they have a very low number of people, and they've done this before. They've brought people and they've, you know, flew them all over the country to process them, to allow them to have their hearings, to allow them to have the credible fear interviews. And so it's not something that the Biden administration cannot do. So the reason why Title 42 is still in place is beyond me, because I don't think it's necessary. There are plenty of places to house foreign nationals when they come into the country while they pursue their reasonable fear or credible fear, whatever it may be, interviews.
When you look at this of where it goes from here, I mean, obviously this entire issue is so complicated and so overlapped in one thing. It's a domino effect, obviously. So where does this go from here?
Well, it's really a decision of the executive. So, I mean, I hope that I saw chatter late last night that there were some mumblings that the Biden administration is thinking about doing this, and that's good.
Good news, there was chatter. Bad news, they were mumbling.
Doing what? doing what, Sarah?
Of ending this executive fiat around Title 42. If you're saying where do we go from here more broadly, this is an access to justice issue, and The results are preliminary, so I shouldn't say this. This is the first time I'm saying this publicly. The detention outreach project from 3 years ago, where folks were brought to the Albany County Jail, mm-hmm. we're starting to do research on where are those folks now? What was the project valid, or was it just, you know, what happened and did it matter? And it did. I'm not going to misquote statistics because my students are still working the numbers, but I will say we have, out of over 300 people, we have a significant number who have won their asylum claims and are now on the path to citizenship. We have over 85 people who are still waiting for their hearing, but they've passed through the first several hurdles. And most importantly, they were released from Batavia. Exactly. So they haven't been living the last 3 years of their lives separated from their families in a cold detention facility. They're living with their families from Maine to California to Wisconsin to Florida. And, now's not the time to tell the full story, but it's remarkable what just access to a lawyer did for these people who could have been turned away if they had arrived 6 months later.
And I mean, you have to understand the logistics of it, right? When you have everyone coming into Texas, you have these immigration judges in Texas that are just kind of jaded, they're overworked. But when you're able to move people around the country, you have people who have the opportunity to have a New York judge hear their story, have Ohio judge hear their story. And so that has a different result. You have different nonprofits that are available and have the resources to represent them. So I think, you know, with this title being gone, I mean, I think it will encourage DHS to move people around the country again. And then we'll see more asylum claims going through.
We welcome your letters on this and other issues. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Let us go to a couple of letters. We still want letters on faith, but here we go. I've not heard panelists speak on the evils that organized religion has perpetrated through history. Religion, however, is not faith. The panel has never spoken out against faith. Rather, the panel is against the misuse of power, both religious and civil. So, see, we have our own
lobby group.
Yeah, there. Right. We have counsel. That's nice. Mm-hmm. All right. I think we had another letter. I would like, wouldn't it be smarter to move all immigrants coming to red state borders to blue states where the Democrats would process them quickly and fairly?
Yeah, well, so part of this.
So about that.
After we provided access to counsel, they stopped sending them to our area, right? So they, I should say the Trump administration when I say they, but oftentimes it's the federal government, no matter who's in charge of it, tends to, under the Trump administration, it was particularly intensive and intentional that we think sent folks to places where they would not be close to lawyers, where they would not be close to favorable judges, where they would not be able to seek assistance. So we're still trying to figure that out. That's all I'll say about that.
And the Trump appointee immigration judges were just impaneled. We had a whole bunch of Trump appointee judges just come on the bench. So I don't think we expect that the judges are going to be a big deterrent or, you know, but what we're looking for is just access, right? Access to nonprofits who can provide this representation or other private attorneys. And so I think that's the most important thing in this situation.
In some of the cases from Albany, the cases have been terminated in court, which is a fancy term for basically, it sounds like there was another basis for them to be able to achieve immigration status outside of immigration court, which is always great because then you don't have to go to trial. You don't have to do all this stuff. We don't know much about those cases, but it's a good sign, right? That we are prejudging these families every single time we talk about immigration. Every time.
Remember earlier when we were talking about athletes and the NCAA? Well, just moments ago, the U.S. Supreme Court mm-hmm. cleared the way for greater compensation for student athletes in a ruling that may loosen the NCAA's grip over college sports. In a victory for college athletes, the Supreme Court unanimously invalidated a portion of the NCAA's amateurism rules. The court says the NCAA can no longer bar colleges from providing athletes with education-related benefits, such as free laptops or paid postgraduate internships. It was an antitrust case that is now holding an order allowing greater compensation for student athletes.
I think this is great. You know, I have a grandchild, Mosiah Augustus, who is a beautiful child and a guy who knows how to really hit. So now we don't have to worry too much about how we're going to send him to college.
Yeah, you just got to make sure he's good on in sports. That's all.
Oh, he's good.
Well,
in
he's good, but okay. But then, yeah.
But he, then,
well,
if then, he's not good.
Well, no, I was going to say, but you know, I'm interested in what they mean by compensation.
Yeah, well, and the NCAA makes a ton of money off of a lot of black and brown athletes.
I believe it's a gazillion dollars.
18 gazillion dollars.
Make a lot of money off of it, right?
Yeah.
Off of the athletes who really then don't get anything after that and may or may not get a shot at the pros.
It's really disgusting. It's like all these rich white men are just getting richer. I mean, these are the guys that are the head of the NCAA and even the Olympics committee. You know, I remember when I was a kid, they had to be amateurs. They couldn't make money off of their sports in order to be considered for the Olympics. And these kids are, you know, struggling, and they deserve to be compensated for what they do because they're making money for other people.
As someone that went to a Big Ten university, University of Michigan, go Blue. I can say that you know, so the football players alone, like they spend all day like practicing. They're there early in the morning. It's very hard for them to keep up academically to be able to succeed. So if they're unable to get recruited or drafted, I'm sorry, you can tell I don't follow football, drafted to the NFL, then you know their chances are low. It's important that they have some kind of compensation. I hate to use that word. For all the time that they spend dedicated to this sport. It's really ridiculous. We had classes called Rocks for Jocks where it was just easier for them just because it's so hard for them to find a time to study.
And not to mention the fact that if you are, let's say, you're a star athlete, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and you have your jersey. Well, they won't put your name on the jersey, but they have your number. And they'll sell that jersey for $150 a shot. Well, you're not getting that money. They're getting that money.
Well, wouldn't it be better, though, to take that money and split it up among all the athletes, not only the person who hit all the home runs and threw all the football passes? Am I naive to think that that might be possible?
I don't know. I mean, as a... There's a ranking, like in football specifically, I just speak among the players. Yeah. And there are people that put forth more effort, who have to do more media, who have to do, you know, more special camps than other people on the team. I mean, it depends on, I don't want to get to, like basketball, yeah, maybe you could do something like that because they kind of like all get interchanged in. But the sports like football, where it's so hard on your body.
Right.
And you are going to have long-term effects. And especially if you're one of the starters and you're out there all the time, it's just not fair to like, you know, give everyone a piece of the pie. But it's also not fair to say that your compensation for playing so well on the football team is this excellent education that you don't get to take advantage of.
You seem awfully passionate about this.
Oh, my gosh. My husband watches ESPN all the time. And he talks to me about this all the time. I went to one football game while at Michigan, for the record. I did not enjoy it. I'm pretty sure I napped during it. It was the best time to go to the library,
really?
Actually.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure it was.
So...
But the point, I mean, originally...
I live in the house with someone.
There was originally a concern that, you know, you're recruiting athletes because you're giving them stuff. And, you know, you get cars and all everything, God only knows what, to get them to sign with you. And then the compensation sort of, then that stops. But they're making, again, a gazillion dollars off of these people.
Right, they are.
And of course, there are great disparities between male sports and female sports. Mm-hmm. And there are also great disparities between, well, let's say football and, you know, ice hockey, mm-hmm. for example. But the other thing I don't quite understand in, and we'll have to see more what comes out of this ruling, of then exactly your question, Alan, of, well, then where does the money go and how is it distributed and where... What happens in who sets up that system for giving money to athletes?
Well, so I mean, just for the sake of argument, and I know nothing about this, of course, why should that prevent me from going ahead with it? But why? What if, you know, IBM or somebody like that comes and goes to an athlete who has hit a lot of home runs or thrown a lot of passes and says, we want to pay you for an endorsement?
They can't do that.
Now they can. But under the new rule, they will be able to do that, and that will have very little to do with the college or university saying it's okay.
Well, Katie Ledecky does commercials for milk, and she's a a competitive Olympic swimmer.
Well, she is, but I don't think she's affiliated with the college. Or
no,
the
not anymore.
No,
not anymore.
No,
but when is that the dividing line? Is if you're in college
I think if you decide or in high school. I mean, if you decide that you are going to be an amateur, because originally the Olympics was only amateur athletes,
right?
And then that's no longer the case.
Well, no, because the NBA went and played for our basketball team,
right? And tennis and everything. So because we have to win because we're Americans,
USA,
right. Yeah, right. Go USA,
USA. USA.
So the NIL, you know what that stands for? Name, image, likeness. The NCAA rules that those rules bar athletes to earn money from their name, image, or likeness, even though it's their name, image, and likeness. So if you go out, and I know, Libby, you and I, we play video games all the time. If we were to go play NCAA football on our Xboxes, and they would show athletes from the team that won the previous year, well, that athlete isn't receiving any money for that,
right.
Even though
right,
a gazillion dollars is being made off of
it. It's so unfair.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say, well, it depends, right? Like, so LeBron went straight from high school to the NBA for this very reason,
right?
Yeah.
Right. But football players are not allowed to do that, and so I think it depends on the sport, and it's very funny how the leagues dictate that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a agreement almost between the NCAA and the professional league. Because the fact that the NBA is able to do that and the NFL is not speaks to it just speaks to the big issue. And like that, it should be something that should go across the field.
And how about all those kids who have been screwed out of their money, who have played for years and were great heroes.
Exactly.
And they gotta watch this happening. It's
Or they play for 3 months, do really well, and then have a devastating injury, and then everything's
done.
And
then
done.
That's it.
Yeah, sure.
And then you're out. Okay, we'll take a break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to what?
No, we're just having hand signals.
A strategy session. So good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. It's our last go around with our wonderful panel: Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Sarah Rogerson, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. So we had a request during the break from one of our panelists who said, why don't we talk about the Mike Pence story? So Mike Pence, you may remember, for a while was the vice president of this country.
I'm trying to forget.
Yeah.
And who is actively running for president, of course. Let's forget about that.
I mean, he seems to be very interested in that. Anyway, so he went to a conservative conference over the weekend, and hecklers went after him, heckled him, and they called him a traitor at the conservative conference.
Sure.
So now you'll remember in the what I think is maybe interesting is that
in the insurrection.
Well, during that, in his most recent comments about January 6th, the former Vice President Mike Pence has said that he probably will never see eye to eye with former President Trump on what happened on January 6th.
I'm trying to kill him.
You think?
But that is all he said. He did not criticize the president. He just said they will never see eye to eye. Some audience members yelled traitor and freedom as he addressed the Faith and Freedom Coalition in Orlando, Florida. The taunts were an apparent reaction to Mr. Pence's role in validating Joe Biden's presidential election win. Undeterred, he continued with his 28-minute speech as the hecklers were finally escorted out by police. During his address, Mr. Pence criticized the policies of President Joe Biden and defended those of his Republican predecessor, Donald Trump. So, how do you have your cake and eat it too?
Disgusting. I mean, that's really disgusting. I mean, here they were running down the halls trying to find him, and there was a supposed noose outside to hang him with, and still, despite the fact his family was with him, can you imagine if your family was with you and they were trying to get you and get your family, and you would still support the people who were trying to get you? It's extraordinary.
So Trump supporters' anger at the election result culminated in a protest that morphed into the deadly attack of the Capitol, of course, on January 6th of this year, or from this British publication, 6 January this year. In the immediate aftermath of the attack, Mr. Pence appeared to distance himself from Mr. Trump, who was impeached by lawmakers over the deadly storming of Congress. Mr. Pence condemned those who stormed the Capitol and, unlike Mr. Trump, attended the inauguration of President Biden on the 20th of January. But on Friday, Mr. Pence used part of his speech to praise his former boss and his achievements while in office. "President Trump taught us what Republicans can accomplish when we stand firm on conservative principles and don't back down," Mr. Trump said. "In 48 months, the Trump-Pence administration achieved the lowest unemployment, the most secure border, and the strongest military in the history of the world." Mr. Pence, who has been tipped to be a Republican candidate in the 2024 presidential election, also took aim at President Biden.
So I just want to be clear about something. When I talk about the radical Christian right, these are the people I'm talking about. Okay? I'm putting it out there, so for everybody listening, the faith in, what is it? The faith in family coalition,
yes, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
These are the kinds of people that I'm talking about who weaponize politics to discriminate against people, to elect folks who don't care about democracy and only care about establishing a theocracy. Because honestly, that's what Mike Pence would like. He would like a theocracy in this country based on his tenets of Christianity, which I can tell you is not Sarah's tenets of Christianity.
100%.
And I don't know if you're a Christian or not.
It is not.
Okay, fine. So, and I know it's not Joe's. So, you know, I mean, these are the kinds of people that I'm talking about, folks. I'm not talking about Sarah or Sienna or Joe.
No. And Mike Pence is just living in La La Land. Back to Alan's point, too, or combining the two, if he thinks that, like, he can find some friendlies in that room because, oh, it's just the extremists who showed up on January 6th. And it's not.
It's not.
They're downplaying to their own detriment, but he's in a catch-22 because he can't survive without them.
Right, right.
So what does he travel? I'd be interested to see what kind of security detail he had walking into that place because I can't imagine it.
Well, he
I
has
cannot.
Secret Service assigned to him for the rest of his
life. But, yeah. I mean, you would want a little more than that.
Yeah, I would want. I want
yeah, because there were probably
all
closed carrying in that.
Yes.
They're probably in a state where closed carry is okay. And
okay
he's the
with
enemy.
Him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Alan, I guess it's I think rightfully, but, I mean, you seem sort of as a foregone conclusion that this man has no chance of being president of the United States.
No chance whatsoever.
But he hasn't read that memo.
No. I mean, when you get to be, you know, close and you were being considered and you were at some point thought to be the next up, you're not going to give that up.
Right. And you're a straight white man?
Yeah, you can't do that.
Right.
Straight white man who will not be in a room with a female.
Oh, right.
Well,
straight presenting.
I'm sorry. Again, a reminder, Libby. We have a camera.
Oh, yeah, we have a camera. Hi, guys. I mean, there's always been speculation, but I'm not saying a word.
Okay, so
that's a word.
But it's the point. But it's a good point. I mean, it's why we have yet to visit the Dan Quayle Presidential Library.
That's right. Thank God. Because it would probably be spelled L-I-B-R-Y. Yeah, R-Y. Library.
All right, let's go to this letter. Get a couple letters on the NCAA. I'm sure people are going to take us to task on our conversation about the NCAA because, you know, here we go.
We need Sienna's husband.
Nina says, college athletes know what they're getting into and they're getting a free education. Risk versus benefits, a personal decision. It seems to me that these athletes are more privileged than other students. That's a hard, I don't think all student athletes are created equal in that, but.
No, absolutely
not. It's
hard
to paint them with a broad brush.
And some kids would never have a path to college without athletics. Mm-hmm. They come from, poor families, disadvantaged, historically underrepresented minority groups are the bulk of these athletic
teams. So do you
teams.
Believe that that's enough, Sarah? In other words, is what is the tenor of your remarks now seems somewhat defensive of this letter writer?
No, the opposite. Yeah. You know, I think that the NCAA takes advantage of that because kids are, you know, it's an opportunity for them to level up in society that they wouldn't otherwise have.
And if they make it to the majors or to the professional area, they're going to certainly have a great fortune thrown at them.
But here's the thing, though. If you're going to a Division I school and you're playing a sport, you don't have time to take advantage of the education. That's what we're saying. If you're playing a big Michigan football game on Saturday and you're having to travel there Friday and you have to prep and you have to do media afterwards, when do you have time to study for your poli-sci 101 course
Absolutely.
Like I do, who's sitting there in my library where you're doing all this traveling and getting ready for all of these games that you have to be there for? So no, it's not the same.
When I was a professor at Rutgers early in my teaching career, I got a call from the dean. I think it was the dean saying, we're sending an aspiring athlete over who wants to choose Rutgers, and will you be teaching politics 101, and will he fit in, and all of that. There was a clear message being delivered.
Right.
Let's see. We go to this letter from Garrett, who says, I used to work for a Big Ten athletic department. Most of the coaches outside of the Big Three or Four earn less than the value of a full ride of state scholarship. Football and basketball carry dozens of other programs with their revenue. And all of that tuition is paid for by donors. Why did that letter just weirdly disappear?
Uh-oh. Maybe somebody...
That was weird.
Maybe somebody's... monitoring your
mail.
It
just, like, disappeared.
It's just no longer there.
Get rid of that one.
Huh.
Look in your deleted file.
Yeah, but I didn't touch it. You saw me. Yeah. Okay, oh, all right. Maybe this is the rest of the letter. Okay, yeah. Here we go. From Garrett. I used to work for a Big Ten athletic... I'm holding my hands up so I know I don't touch this. Most of the coaches outside of the Big Three or Four earn less than the value of a full ride of state scholarship. Football and basketball carries dozens of other programs with their revenue, and all of that tuition is paid for by donors and the TV money at most / all state schools. Another factor is there are a dozen or more schools, I used to think of them as the Nike League, are not the same as the other 95% in their ability to print money. All
yeah,
right.
100%.
There is that. Then, Caitlin Ohashi, I believe is how it's pronounced, is a perfect example of an athlete who should have been able to profit off of her likeness. She was an NCAA gymnast at UCLA whose floor routine went viral. She subsequently won an ESPY award in UCLA, and the NCAA profited off of her popularity. Then we go to... this one, you insinuate Mike Pence's sexuality is different than what is presented and laugh at it. You should be embarrassed. We weren't laughing actually at that. We were laughing at
me.
What Libby did. Okay. I know that may not make it better, but it does. That's what we were laughing at. And okay, so let's go to...
But that doesn't mean that Mike Pence is not a jerk.
Right, because he is. A big fat one.
No, he's not fat.
But he's a big fat jerk in that metaphorical kind of way.
Metaphorically, he's a jerk. Yeah.
All right. Metaphorically.
Because I'm not going to sit here and get the letters about using that adjective about anybody.
But I am, so.
Well, you may, but it's so unfair to me.
Yes, but I am overweight, so I can say it with impunity.
All right.
Without impunity, I'm not sure how that goes.
We have 2 minutes. I want to get into, I don't want to get into a big subject because we won't really have time to like fully explore it since we only have 90 seconds. Because there's this great economy story, which
it's the lightning round.
But it's a great story, but I think we should hold it because we're just not going to have time to get to all of it and figure it out. So I will take the time in thanking our panel for being with us this morning and for digging into the conversation. I greatly appreciate it. Alan, thank you, as always.
And
be
you,
well.
Joe.
Thank you. Sienna, Sarah, Libby, great to have you here, as always. Wonderful to have you in the studio. And thank you for your very insightful remarks. And let's see. That is it. My thanks to all of you. We'll be back right after this.